Don't Leave Me This Way is, of course, the name of the song. Biggest selling single of 1986. And that's music there from the Communards. Let's go 2 years further than that, because in 1988, he would have been introduced on TV as Richard Coles of the Communards. 10 years later, he introduced himself to Cherie Blair as Tom from Bridget Jones' Diary. And less than 10 years after that, he was announced as the Reverend Richard Coles in Lincoln Cathedral. What's for certain is it's been a singular journey, when he's put down in his memoir, Fathomless Riches, or How I Went From Pop to Pulpit. And Richard Coles joins me now to look back on his life today. Richard, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Dave.
At one stage that you never wanted to be in a band, but it was just, and I quote, too good an opportunity to pass up. Has your life been one of lucky occurrences and, or, you know, taking chances?
I think so. I think I'm one of those people who sort of drifted into one thing after another. And also, in some ways, been very lucky. I mean, the real stroke of luck was that I managed to bump into Jimmy Somerville in London in 1981. And that was really the source of most of my good fortune. Spectacularly talented person. And I managed to, jump into his slipstream. So it was largely, that was a very big stroke of luck.
And Jimmy Somerville would be known to any pop picker type persons from the earlier 80s in terms of the Bronski Beat and all the rest of it, and just some very powerful singles in particular, Top of the Pops appearances, etc., and the cover of Smash Hits and all the rest. Were you a Smash Hits cover kind of pop person there, Richard?
Well, whenever we did promotion, Dave, I got the sense that they were always trying to make me stand at the back in the dark. So they used to put me behind a keyboard and sort of cast the light elsewhere, because I don't think I was ever quite... I mean, you could look at me in a video and it's quite obvious there's a vicar struggling to get out. And in the end, indeed, he did get out.
Right, indeed. Yeah. By the way, the getting out, becoming a vicar, was there a eureka moment, or did you kind of always know?
Well, I think in retrospect, looking back, I think from the age of 8, I began to have a sort of itch for it. But it wasn't until I was in my late 20s when I had a very powerful, dazzling conversion experience that all of a sudden it became thinkable. And then once I was in, I found it was my natural habitat and indeed my mother tongue, and then it sort of went on from there.
And what is it that you liked about religion? I mean, was it the liturgy? Was it the music? Or did you have any kind of head-scratching moments about the content?
Well, I always felt at home in the world. I always felt at home in the music, and I was a chorister when I was a boy, so I grew up with that. And I always liked the sort of atmosphere of church, and also the sort of ironic humour of the clergy I quite liked. But I thought it was a load of old nonsense, a fairy tale. Although the radicalism of Jesus, I think, was something that always impressed me. And I think it's the radicalism of Jesus, what it has to say about the world, about, you know, the first being last, and about the poor being rich and having to give away everything you have in order to have anything worth having. That kind of stuff still really resonates for me now.
And the smell of incense, you're always into that, I presume, yeah?
Well into that. Well. Trinage Rosa Mystica, that's my favourite brand for any listeners out there.
There are different brands!
There are different brands.
No, I should have known, I didn't know.
Oh, Trinage Rosa Mystica is by far the best.
Okay, all right, well, let's just take a look then, because, like, you know, when the Church of England, the chief medical officer takes a look at what I will call an application, or whatever one has to do to become part of it all, you have to tell the truth, you were honest. There was a sort of a big list of drugs, a lot bigger than a lot of other people might have taken. Was there a little bit of, like, oh, my God, we can't have this guy?
Well, I wouldn't have been in the least bit surprised if they said no way, but I did fill in the form dutifully. And, of course, you know, being an 80s pop star, sex and drugs and rock and roll was sort of part of the diet. So I sort of sent it off and thought, well, I wouldn't be in the least surprised if they kind of bin this as soon as they get it. But he phoned me up at work, and then we had this... Excuse me. And then we had this sort of hour and a half conversation in which we tried to work out what drugs I'd actually taken, because I only knew the street names for them and he only knew the pharmacological names for them. But we got there in the end.
That's probably how you got through, all right. You both misunderstood each other. Okay, the book is fairly frank in its detailing of the story of your life up to ordination. Were you worried at all that there might be repercussions? That, I mean, like, you know, you do say at the outset that you frittered much in splendour and awfulness, and that you had tried to be as candid as possible about that. Is that the way it is? Yeah, do you think, like, you know you're going to annoy some people?
Well, I'm sure I'm going to annoy some people and upset some people, and I don't set out deliberately to do that, but I did realise the minute I started writing it that I could only do it with candour, because it's a conversion story, really, and, you know, it's not just about converting to something, it's converting from something, and I needed to be candid with people about that. And I think, you know, you owe candour at the very least to people. The other thing, of course, is I spend a lot of my time talking to the Women's Institute and the Mothers' Union, and I honestly have yet to find anything I could say which caused them so much as to bat an eyelid. You know, people can take this stuff, I think.
Oh, absolutely, except, of course, the Daily Mail this week. There's plenty of stuff in there. There are many, not necessarily lurid, by the way, accounts of finding, and I'll quote, comfort in strangers. The first few pages recall an encounter in a lay-by Yes. And it's not the only one. So, like, that's just the way it is. This is life. This is my life. This is my book.
Well, it was then. It seemed like a very, I don't have to say, you know, as a gay man in London and around London in the 1980s and the 90s, opportunities for sex were plentiful and many. It was just how it was. And I took my fair share. It's kind of in the past now, and I wouldn't live like that now. But I can't entirely regret how I lived then, Dave, because to be quite honest, I learnt an awful lot there, and I met some fantastic people, and I think in lots of ways they were very good experiences.
Well, you are now so many different things in terms of strings to the bow and all the rest of it, and, like, you know, everything from Have I Got News For You a few times, Newsnight, or BBC 4, Saturday Live, all the rest, the chaplain of the Royal Academy of Music, God, how many other things are there? You have a BA in Theology at King's College in London, and your mother would be proud, and BBC 4, etc., Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, etc. Well, with all those, with now the Reverend Richard Coles, what does it now mean in terms of, for instance, the gay Reverend Richard Coles? Are you the go-to gay guy? I mean, like, you know, there's a television programme out in the world, a global gay history. Oh, get Coles!
Well, obviously, anything which enhances my saleability to my employer is only too grateful to have.
very good.
Fact is, of course, Dave, there are lots of gay clergy. There always have been, there always will be. I suppose I'm a bit more prominent than some at the moment. But also, you know, I've got a lot of other things to say. I'm very interested in what the church has to say about global poverty, very interested in what the church has to say about how we deal with the marginalised and the excluded in our own communities. And, you know, I'm very glad to have an opportunity to bang the drum about that.
Well, just on that point of marginalised and excluded from community, when I mentioned the Out in the World, a Global Gay History, did you learn a lot from doing that, realising, wow, how different it is to be gay in London or to be gay in some African country?
Well, I think I learned two things. One was that wherever you look, there were gay people being gay, in spite of a sort of history which only really became visible in the 19th century. But the other thing was how different it was for different people. You would have people who we would identify as gay who were living maybe in ancient Egypt or in Native American cultures, who would have thought of themselves as something quite different. So I think it tells you that the experience is very rich and complex and not monolithic, and it doesn't do us any good to sort of treat it as if it were just one big thing. Mm. I think it's a very complex tale of human intricacy and beauty and grace and all that kind of stuff.
Indeed, and getting back to faith and non-faith, I mean, looking back at your early years, do you recognise the teenager who organised an atheists club at school?
Yes, I must have. God, it must have been so annoying to my chaplains when I was at school. But I think, like lots of people, I felt angry about religion because actually I took it seriously. I think the danger for religion is not people who are hostile; it's people who are indifferent.
Okay, like between about 83 and 87, I know I'm jumping all over the place here, but music wise, I mean, the biggest band in terms of the cool alternative NME band was the Smiths, say, because they were there for those 4 years. You were right there in the middle of all of that, and that was post punk. I mean, punk had gone. I would have got the impression, though, that you might have been sort of tinged by, or at least, you know, been motivated by punk, but no, you weren't.
Well, I think, of course, I think in a way anything which happened after 1986 in popular culture was affected by punk. And I think really the alternative gay scene, as sociologists persist in calling it, which happened in London around the 80s, was very much influenced by that. It was a sort of gay world that came up post-punk. But in terms of music, I think we were much more interested in disco, in what was happening in disco. Yeah. If you're a gay man, the place of liberation, the place of self-discovery and all that was actually in the disco. So what might have seemed like a sort of very mainstream, anodyne sort of place to some was for some of us a place of liberation.
So in other words, less Never Mind the Bollocks, more Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, but I loved Never Mind the Bollocks. I love the Sex Pistols. But I also did love Saturday Night Fever and indeed could do the John Travolta dance. It was a party trick of mine. It still casts, my mother still goes white at the thought of it.
Really? Yeah, I'm just trying to picture that one myself.
It's not a good look. Really,
oh, 6 foot
look,
what of you, by the way? You're very tall. What height are you?
No, I'm not. I'm 6 foot, although I notice I'm of an age now where I seem to shrink a millimetre or two every month.
Well, maybe I'll tell you, I know what it was. It was always little and large to me because Jimmy was very small.
That's right. Jimmy was sort of just a little over 5 foot, and so I did rather tower over him in physical stature. But I have to say, he rather towered over me in every other sense. A very, you know, remarkable person.
And Tom Robinson. Just take a look at Tom Robinson. For those who remember 2468 Motorway and all the rest of them, Glad to Be Gay, etc. Coming out to your parents was helped by Tom Robinson. In what way exactly?
Well, I thought I was 16 and I nervously knew that it was time that I did sort of tell people about this. And I couldn't think of a way of telling my mum. So in the end, I made her sit down and listen to Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay. I think it was three times before she finally said to me, darling, are you trying to tell me something? So she got it.
And is it a question of being happier and embracing your sexuality when you leave home? You leave home and you say, right, now I know who I am.
I think what happened was that it would have been so difficult for me to have come to any sort of rich maturity growing up in a little provincial town in England in the late 70s. I kind of knew that London would be the place where I had to go to do that. And I was fortunate to have an opportunity to do it, although... Of course, I'm back where I started now, interestingly.
Well, we'll get there too, because just after the Communards, I mean, it didn't last too long, it was only a few years in the mid-80s. Did you lose yourself after the Communards before you found whatever it is you found?
Absolutely. I did that sort of classic pop star thing of crashing and burning. You know, I'd got to 30 and I had more money than sense. I didn't have to work. And I thought, well, maybe the most fun I've ever had in my life is now over. What the hell do I do next? And so I took a year out. And in the course of that year out, I just had a rather wild experience with drugs. And the first 6 months of that year, I think, were the most fun I ever had. And the second 6 months, I don't really remember, which is perhaps a blessing. But it all got a bit sort of murky at the end.
And had it been a bit murky even, before the Communards? I mean, you do talk 1980 about the brave new world of opportunities, very different to rural Northamptonshire, the council grant thing, the arts council grant, welfare. It was the golden age for the middle-class wastrel. I mean, you had a good time in London, did you?
I did. I mean, I was just very lucky, really. There was still an opportunity. If you were kind of young, you could run away to London, you could get yourself somewhere to live, you could sign on the dole, and you could sort of get together with like-minded people and start something. And I've always been very lucky at managing to find myself around somewhere when things begin, when nobody really knows what they're doing. And that's, you know, a very creative time. It was also just a moment in history. I mean, I look at it, I've got nieces at university now who are going to be leaving university with £50,000 worth of debt, which is rather going to concentrate their minds as they go forward into careers. Of course, I didn't have any of that. We were much freer in our choices, I think, back then, and it was a more generous material world back then than it is now.
But also London 1980, the politics of the left, a very unifying force. I mean, it says it all from the point of view, like, when being gay is far less newsworthy and when cynicism about politics is so widespread, that your involvement then in a radical gay theatre company was taken... I mean, it was just who and what you were.
Yeah, and it was, you know, bliss was it in that dawn to be alive and to be young was very heaven.
Indeed.
It was a very great, exciting and dynamic time. But one of the reasons why it was great and exciting and dynamic was also it was shot through with some really challenging and difficult things. And I think one of the reasons we became who we were was because we were kind of fighting and struggling as well as enjoying ourselves.
When you came to the Communards, you were a piano player, you were a sax player, you were a fringe theatre person, you had done an awful lot of things. And what did you expect to get when you joined up with Jimmy and you said, look, this guy's a bit of a pop star from Bronski Beach, what are we doing here?
Well, there were two things. One was just the sheer excitement of working with Jimmy, who's just a very exciting person to be around. And also that we were trying to be young gay men doing something that was quite self-defining. And that was very important.
Yeah.
But also it was life transforming. You know, I'd been on the dole, Dave. I was living hand to mouth. And then all of a sudden I signed to a major record label and they gave me a check for 60,000 quid. And I thought, I felt like a lottery winner. Well, it was like a lottery winner. And then, rather tellingly, they also give you a sort of golden hello, a present. And most people ask for a motorbike or something. And I asked for a washer dryer.
I see. Okay, I'm going to let that one hang on its own there for a minute. Okay. You were like, you know, if you like in the recent movie Pride, you were involved in the miners' strike, the seminal moment, if you like, in Britain in the first half of the 1980s, right through the middle parts of the first half. Tell me about that. Like, were you a hardened lefty? Were you going to Socialist Worker Party meetings?
Well, I did go to Socialist Worker Party meetings, but I always found them a little rough for me. And I was much more armchair Marxism, I suppose, and champagne socialism was probably much more my thing. But it was a very vibrant time on the left. And, of course, Margaret Thatcher had formed a government in 1979. So, you know, there were clear divisions in society. You kind of knew where you were and you knew who the enemy was. And there was everything to fight for. So those were sort of bracing times. And the left was full of drama and excitement and lots going on. And we kind of fell out with each other and we fell in with each other and we went on marches. And in some ways, you look back on it in a cynical era and think it all seems... a little bit like a sort of, you know, a little bit ridiculous. But it was a life-changing experience for me. And the best thing of all in it was being in Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners, which is fascinating now to all of a sudden see a wonderful social comedy in the cinemas about it. But, I mean, I was there, and that experience of finding, as gay men and women living in London, we could find common cause with a bunch of working-class Welsh miners in the Delice Valley was a wonderful experience for all of us.
And the ironic realisation that, as you say yourself, one of the great achievements of Thatcherism was to unite the communities it despised.
Well, quite so. And solidarity forever.
Indeed. Now, let me just take a look then at some of the... Like, what about the Billy Bragg kind of things, Paul Weller, Gary Kemp, even the Red Wedge thing, and etc. Was Red Wedge good? What was it?
Well, Red Wedge was a group of mostly musicians who came together with a view to trying to get young people to engage with politics. And all of us were on the left. And the idea was that somehow we could try to mobilise and galvanise young people in the run-up to elections in the 1980s when Neil Kinnock was leader of the Labour Party. And so we did that. And, of course, the idea that somehow you could galvanise young people into voting down Thatcherism in the early 80s was perhaps slightly overambitious when I think about it now. But it was a great experience. We had a lovely time, and there were lots of things we did in that which I'm very proud of, although we certainly didn't succeed in what we set out to do.
Okay, what more or less brought you and Jimmy Somerville together was, if you like, the alternative gay scene of London in the late 1980s. But by the same token, you felt a bit like a second wheel in some ways from very early on in our partnership. You say a resentment began to build. Like, was that from the word go? Was it? I mean, your backgrounds couldn't have been more different.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons why Jimmy and I, when we worked together well, was that we were so different. You know, I was kind of middle class, public school educated Englishman, and Jimmy came from a very tough working class background in Glasgow. But the other thing about Jimmy was that he did have this extraordinary charisma, and to stand near him was to stand near someone who it often felt like was taking your light and your air. And of course, I was young and not really very sensible, and I didn't really think it through. But I did feel this intense resentment that Jimmy did get so much attention and so much credit. And of course, I was sort of vain and silly and wanted some of that myself. But it was rather difficult to admit that. And so I did get these kind of surging jealousies, which I had to kind of bank down and keep to myself. Although I would occasionally blurt them out and we'd have these ridiculous rows, which I'm embarrassed about now. But, you know, but there you are.
And one of the things, by the way, you did make the front of the Kettering Evening Telegraph, so shut up, for God's sake. Now, hold on
exactly.
A second. There's one gig you mentioned, a Dublin gig, because so many bands who tour often, they start off here in Dublin on the tour, and that can often be the one that goes horribly wrong, or the one that I'm most tense about, or one that's weird, or whatever. What's your Dublin gig experience like?
Well, I remember two Dublin gigs in particular. The one I remember most vividly was at the Stadium, and it was the first gig we did in UK and Ireland after our record had gone to number one. And before that, we'd sort of played the gigs which were full of kind of students soberly applauding our attempts to kind of galvanise the political realities. And also, we came on stage, we were confronted by a crowd of screaming girls who threw stuff on the stage. It's so enthusiastic were they to see us. So it was that dramatic. It was all of a sudden I realised we'd become a different sort of band. And I was a bit thrown by it at first. But Jimmy, of course, who was at the front, kind of cruised, surfed that stuff like a surfer a wave, and did that rather brilliantly. And we came off stage and I said, oh God, they didn't listen to anything we had to say. And then I think we had a row then, actually. But I remember that very, very vividly. And the other venue that was a great place to play in Dublin was SFX.
Oh yeah, the SFX.
Do you remember?
Of course.
St. Francis Xavier, I think.
Yeah, that's right, indeed. Does he go into one of your weird... Didn't you do a thing about unrecognised saints? Would Francis Xavier be a recognised one? Sorry, title wrong there.
No, sorry, but I wrote a couple of books about the sort of B-list saints, if I can be so facetious, and St. Francis Xavier is certainly not B-list.
He's A-list, is he? All right.
Absolutely.
I do remember the SFX and the stadium very well indeed, yeah. Okay, so let's take a look then. The arrival of AIDS, did that change everything in terms of the way you lived or in terms of the music or in terms of... Like, for instance, when you say in 86 it was All These Girls or whatever year it was, because like the biggest selling single of 1986 was Don't Leave Me This Way by you guys, the Communards. Yeah. But like that had been out before by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes or something. Did people, when you... did people think that you were Harold Melvin at some stage? Was there any kind of... Like, you know, you were disco in 86, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Hard luck if lots of girls come along here with disco. That's what they want.
Well, yeah, it was ridiculous. I can remember once being in playing in Belfast, and some girls had got into our hotel room, and then we sort of found them there, and then we realised they didn't quite know what they were doing there. We didn't quite know what we were doing there, so we all sat down and had a cup of tea and a chat, I remember. So it was quite surprising to find ourselves the focus of that kind of interest.
Right.
But, you know, a great song is a great song, and Don't Leave Me This Way has been covered by lots of people, and it is a warhorse of a song. It can survive, you know, all sorts of treatment, and it, you know, we did very nicely out of it. So thank you very much.
Right. When I mentioned AIDS there, by the way, you for a while pretended to be HIV positive.
Yes, I did.
Why?
Not my finest. In the middle of the 1980s, at a time of our greatest success, when in a way you'd think it was the best of times, all of a sudden it was the worst of times because HIV came along and lots of people we knew and were very close to got suddenly desperately ill and then died in this plague in a way which you think, you know, had kind of was a sort of medieval thing and not something that could happen to people here and now. And I think lots of us were very affected by that and a bit traumatized by that and a bit mad. And then I came down on tour with shingles, which was one of often seen as a sign of that you might be infected with HIV because it's, you know, sign of a suppressed immune system. And I got into my head that I was HIV positive because I could well have been. And I went off and had a blood test. And then in those days, you had to wait, I think, a week or two before the results. And I started telling people I was HIV positive, and then I got the result back and it was HIV negative. But by then I'd sort of made up this story.
Yeah.
And truthfully, I think there was a sort of madness about that. And then in the end, of course, I realised how shameful it was to kind of walk around with that story. When, of course, there were lots of people walking around for whom it wasn't a story but reality. And eventually I had to tell people that I had made it up and look a complete idiot and repent and sort of make amends and you know, that was a very tough thing to do.
Well, it's all there in black print on the white pages. Just want to stay with this for a second. Fathomless Riches, by the way, is what we're looking at. Fathomless Riches, or How I Went From Pop to Pulpit. It's the Reverend Richard Coles is who we're talking to here. And Richard, after all that, like, you know, there is a thing where the Communards made lots of money. The hotels got bigger, the plane travel got better, you bought property and all that. And you were a big successful band, and you say, well, let me just get this quote here to get used to the widening distance between what you say you are about and what you actually become. You even passed a BBC picket to do Top of the Pops. Were you kind of ending your hardline left-wing politics, and are you a little circumspect about it maybe in the book?
Well, I think I perhaps was finding that, you know, a very narrowly and sharply defined doctrine of any kind is very hard to live in a world which deals with greys rather than blacks and whites. I think also if you're in a pop band, all of a sudden actually what you really are is a small businessman. And so we had this small business and we had to promote our product. And so I did wrestle with that a bit. But anyway, we did cross the picket line. And I think shamefully, we did so in a van with blacked out windows so no one would see our shame in particular. But of course, living in the gap between what you aspire to be and what you actually are is very good preparation for being a Christian, Dave. So, I do a lot of that now, living in that gap, if you see what I mean.
I do, I see exactly what you mean. Now, we mentioned then the years after that post-band, the time was ripe for the ecstasy-fueled wilderness years, if you like. But then came religion, and let's get back to that one again. You joined, can I say the enemy? You mean you joined the Catholic Church for 10 years? I mean, I don't know.
No, I think lots of people did think that. And, I mean, as soon as I did find my way to Christianity, it was to Catholic Christianity that I found my way. First of all, in the Church of England, in the version of it that we have in the Church of England. But the more I got into that, the more I was drawn to the original and best, if you see what I mean. And also, I was very much attracted to monastic life and began to spend a lot of my time in Benedictine communities and thought, well, that might be the life for me. So I became a Roman Catholic and did, I think, 10 years, I think, as a Roman Catholic. And the irony was, although I'd say there were 10 wonderful years, and I've only got got the greatest respect and affection for my experience then. The irony was I discovered I was actually Church of England. I had to leave the Church of England to discover that that's in fact what I was. So I came back.
Okay, what about that home then, to get back to something we were talking about earlier on in terms of the sexuality? I mean, Church of England, it does fudge on homosexuality. It allows its parishioners to be, it's permissible for the priests to be, but you have to be celibate. I mean, come on.
Well, tell me about it. I mean, it is Anglicanism. I've always wanted to do a church bazaar and to sell sort of homemade sweets and do little bags of things called classic Anglican fudge. I think it would be a huge seller. It's what we do because we are a church of a sort of mixed identity, a church with a personality disorder. We're a bit of this and we're a bit of that, and somewhere in the fuzziness and indistinctness, there's a little bit of wiggle room for things to happen.
Right.
Perhaps more than in the Roman Catholic Church, I'd say. And of course, that's one of the great frustrations of the Church of England, but it also is, I think, perhaps one of its strange blessings. And we try to work that out. I can't say it's a satisfactory position now.
And in working that out, would I say it's a kind of an unsatisfactory compromise, but at least it's a compromise? I mean, like, you live with somebody, so do you pass the test?
Well, technically we do, although it gets into all sorts of embarrassing detail about quite how intimate is intimate, if you see what I mean. But I know I have a civil partner, David, who's also an Anglican priest, and we live together a very contented and very happy, committed, but celibate relationship, which is something which kind of suits us well enough to live that way, and also happens to coincide with sort of current Anglican thinking on what's best practice for its clergy. But I'm not pretending that that's either easy or desirable. It's just where we are.
Right. OK, well, listen, we're going to just one or two last ones, Richard. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Fathomless Riches, or How I Went From Pop to Pulpit, is the actual name of the book, The Reverend Richard Coles, and it is a fascinating story. By the way, it's not Lionel Richie from the Commodores. I'm sure at some stage, somewhere, somebody might have thought that, did they?
Well, I once was started in a new parish and a little face appeared in a window and it was a lady and I invited her in and she said, "We thought you were black." And it turned out she did think it was the Commodores and that I was Lionel Richie.
Yeah,
I'm sorry to disappoint.
Yeah, it's Richard Coles, actually, from the Communards, but the song might be the same. Okay, the book takes us up to your ordination. Is that, do you think, the end of that particular story? Another, no doubt, to follow, maybe? Or
no, there's another, at least one other book to follow. But of course, I have to tell the story in a very different way because as a priest, obviously, things are different, so I'm at the moment just beginning finding a way of doing that.
And by the way, Bridget Jones aside, do we hold you responsible for the TV comedy show Rev?
Well, I'd love to take credit for it because I think it's so wonderful, but I was merely one person in among many who I think informed that programme, which I absolutely adored.
By the way, 1871, the short-lived Paris Commune in the wake of France's defeat of the Franco-Prussian War, in the Franco-Prussian War. Where on earth did you come up with the name Communards? There.
We went with a friend of ours who was the General Secretary of the Young Communist League, and he took us and we saw the wall against which the Communards were shot and we all got a bit carried away with it. And so it seemed like a good idea at the time, but, you know, I sometimes sympathise with Sting, who, you know, in your 50s and 60s, you must sometimes wish you'd picked a different name. But there you go.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Absolutely. OK, by the way, Jimmy Somerville, you did meet him at St Pancras at a station many years later. You haven't kept in touch over the last 25, 30 years much, have you?
Oh, well, we've just begun. We've sort of been in and out of touch, really. I mean, and just lately we started having an email conversation because we've both, since I've written the book and everything, I got in touch with Jimmy and said, lots about you. Do you want to see it? And he said, no, write your story and we'll talk about it. And so we have been in touch then and revisiting the past, and it's been lovely, actually.
Absolutely. And by the way, of all the things that I mentioned earlier on, too, in terms of telly that people would have seen you on, from Have I Got News For You about three or four times, and Newsnight Reviews and BBC Radios and all the rest that you do, and QI, of course, as well. You're on Celebrity Mastermind.
Yes.
And you won.
I did, yes, by fluke, I think. I ridiculously took it seriously, and I think I was the only person who'd done any homework, and I did, I won.
Well, the obvious question, what was your specialist subject?
The Map and Lucia novels of E.F. Benson. So I didn't have to do that much homework, frankly, Dave. It's a wonderful, wonderful social comedy set in the south of England and the Midlands in the 20s and 30s, yeah.
Really, I'd love to ask you 10 questions on it now, but I won't. Okay, listen, Richard, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. This is only part one. There will surely be a part two and three. Fathomless Riches, or How I Went From Pop to Pulpit, the Reverend Richard Coles. Richard, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for talking to us this morning.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to talk to you too.